1, 2. Hallo. Ja. Ja, nej, men det går bra där. Så. Tack. If anybody's online, sorry for the delay. Technical issues. With the streaming in the regular classroom, so we move to a new one. Let me see if I can find my lecture summary. Okay, we'll start in a few minutes. Okay. Hope you can hear me okay online. Little delay, like I said. Technical problems with the A146, the regular classroom today, so we moved into K105. Welcome to the last lecture of IMT 4116. Today we're going to do a short summary or recap and a couple of exam tips. I guess that's why there's so many here. So, first of all, I want to go back to a couple of the slides that I started this course with, where I said that the goal was to give the students theoretical and practical knowledge of reverse engineering and malware analysis. I hope you have achieved that, because this is, like I said also, I provide the opportunity and you either take it or not. So if you feel that you reached that goal, that is your hard work. I know that maybe you think that, hey, I don't know enough, but this comes with practice, as we talked about many times. In the beginning, I had this. Overview of the following topics: malware methodology, basic analysis, advanced static analysis, advanced dynamic, anonymous and stealthy analysis, malware classification and functionality, anti-reverse engineering, and malware lab and workshop. And as I go through quickly each chapter, no detail, just an overview, I hope that you see that we have at least in my opinion, and you're allowed to disagree, I think we have covered all of this. This is the final update of the course content that I put out on Blackboard on May 8th, showing all that we have covered. So week 2, introduction, setting up the lab, getting your computer to work. Then I had a malware introduction and basic analysis in week 3. Not sure how much malware introduction it was. I think it was mostly the basic analysis. And then week 4, more basic analysis, but this time with the focus on dynamic techniques, so when the code is running. Week 5, advanced static analysis. That was a crash course in disassembly, assembly codes. A hard crash if you haven't seen it before. And also IDA Pro was introduced then. Then week 6, recognizing C code and Windows constructs in assembly. Then week 7, we had a workshop. First time we had Kato visiting from NoSart. And also assignment 1, your first attempt to write a malware report. Week 8, analyzing malicious Windows programs. Then there was a winter break. Or at least for me, you were probably doing assignment 1. week 10, advanced dynamic analysis, debugging with the teaching assistant, Sergey Banin. Then we had anonymous and stealthy analysis. Week 12, malware classification and functionality. Then week 13 was canceled due to sickness in my family, so there was no lecture. Then we had Kato visiting again with workshop number 2 and assignment number 2. Easter vacation, again for me, but not for you since you had assignment 2. Then the cyber defense, and Alexander Björke was visiting in week 17, talked about anti-reverse engineering, and no lecture on May 1st. And then I had chapter 13, which should have been in week 13. I have that in week 19, which came a little bit late because you had already used most of it or a lot of it in assignment 2. But it's really important chapter, so I chose to cover it. And then week 20 today, summary, and 10:15, we have a guest lecture from Gunnar Alendal from Kripos, PhD student also at NTNU. It's something different. It's not malware, but it's more breaking hardware. But I really think it's worth watching. And then I'll come back to that. The biggest, the most scary thing is left, the exam. I also gave you this in the beginning, that this course would have 2 assignments associated with workshop with a pass and fail. 72-hour home exam and assess 1-hour oral exam. It will not be more than that. It's probably going to be somewhere in between half an hour and 45 minutes. I need to set up the schedule. Right now there you are 16 students, so there will be 8 students per day. I'll show that later. And 1 hour is a little bit much. So 2 assignments, pass and fail. You have to pass both in order to take the home exam. And everybody should know their result there now. If you're not sure, get in touch with me. Then you turn in the home exam, and I have to grade it. I give it a temporary grade. And that has to be a passing grade for you to be able to take the oral examination. And then I use the oral examination to adjust the grade up or down and make sure that you did it. And because when you're sitting at home, it's... you have all the resources in the world, and that's okay because it's that's what real life work in this field is like. But it also, I need to test that you actually understood what you did and that you didn't copy your friend or just copied whatever you found on the internet. And that's what the oral examination is about, figuring out, see that you really understand what you turned in. And of course, you have to pass both parts to get a grade. And we will be able to do this online, and that I'll summarize towards the end. So that was what I introduced in the beginning. And now I'll do a quick recap. The curriculum, if you haven't bought this book by now, it's you should. Just joking. If you haven't, then you've probably failed already. This book is where you find most of the curriculum. But remember this one. Pay attention to the lectures that we've had, and especially the workshops and guest lectures from Cyfor has not been strictly to the book. So worth taking a look at those lectures. In the beginning, I talked about cyber kill chain and how we can use that to understand the actions necessary for the attacker to launch an launch or get the action on objective that they are after. Reconnaissance is important. Then they go home and make a weapon, PDF or Word document or something. Then they deliver it, maybe through email, like you've seen in assignment 2. Then they exploit the vulnerability. They install, hide somewhere, maybe create persistence. They call home on the command and control channel, and then they do whatever they want to do, whether it's key logging or stealing hashes or, like we've seen in the news now, encrypting all your data and ask for money. If you read the news and you follow the development there, I think you'll recognize many of the things that they're talking about will fall nicely into these different steps. This is one method, not the only one, but many find this one useful. Just want to say right away that, and I'll come back to it too, but this is important to understand this these seven steps. I said in the beginning of the course that we were going to try to work these seven steps into the reports. I don't think we quite succeeded in doing that. So I'm not expecting you to succeed with that on the exam either, but understanding this and being able to make some connections to this is still an important part of this this course, and I think it will be helpful if you keep this in mind when you work with this later anyway. Okay, quick walkthrough the book. Part 1 is basic analysis, chapter 1, 2, and 3. This is all about looking at the malware and without running it, and just read what information is there. We talked about antivirus, virus total, hash, fuzzy hash, strings, the file format for the portable executable, the format that we focused on, libraries and functions, import exports, and packed and obfuscated code. And we looked at all this, and the idea here was to find indicators of compromise and then form a hypothesis. What do we think the malware is doing based on this before we go on with the analysis? That has limitations. So then we moved on to basic dynamic. What happens when we run the malware? And we made a 5-step process. Activate monitoring tools, run the malware, terminate the malware, pause the monitoring tools, and then the hard one, examine what happened to our file system, registers, and other things, the internet connection. So this one's important. Then, of course, these are basic techniques. And then we come to the hard things, is the advanced static analysis first. So without running the code, this is covered by chapter 4, 5, 6, and 7. This is where we went through this crash course in assembly, how a microprocessor works, how it actually executes the code, how that code is represented in the binary form, and how we can disassemble it and get the assembly code back. You could also, like Kato did, go one step further and get the C code back. And if you work with this professional, I guess that's the way to go. But we stopped at the assembly level, mainly because IDA Pro, to get the next feature, is extremely expensive, and we weren't able to do that now. Then it's IDA Pro, the de facto standard for analyzing assembly code and disassembly in the this profession right now. There are other tools, but this is what most people use. And then we went through how to recognize C constructs in assembly. And what's important here is that you don't get stuck on individual lines, but that you're able to take a higher view or of the code and see the big picture, and don't get stuck in the details. And then we looked at analyzing malicious Windows program and what to look for with IDA Pro. This is probably the one of the things that is requires most training, to move around in the code and find where in the assembly do I find these functions implemented and understand what's going on. Then there's a short part 3, advanced dynamic. So that's what do we do when the malware is running, chapter 8 and 9. I think there's a chapter 10 too, but Sergei just briefly touched it, so we're not including that in the curriculum. This is about debugging. So you run the malware in a debugger, like Oli Debug, in a control environment where you can decide, where you can control how fast the code is executed, make breakpoints to stop and step through and read out values of variables, stack, registers as you go, and try to understand more dynamically what's going on instead of just reading the assembly code in IDA. Then there were four chapters, 11, 12, and 13, that we covered in whole, and then I partially touched number 14. It would probably be more correct to put that under part 5, never mind that. I'll show you where that fits in. But 11, 12, and 13 deals with malware functionality. Well, we looked at what is the malware trying to achieve. So the malware behavior, how it tries to evade our eyes when it launches. And finally, in chapter 13 that I just lectured, the different encoding schemes, sometimes to hide that it's malware, but also to slow you down in the analysis. Come in. Welcome. You saw the message on the board? Okay, if you can go in and write a much bigger note on the board, that would be great. So, So this was malware functionality. Really quick, here is where chapter 14 fits in. This one we had anonymous and stealthy analysis. We had a lecture about anonymity in general, how different services implement this. Then we talked about going incognito and the operational security of the OPSEC, where you really need to think, when is it okay to go online, when is it not okay, and what's the risk of going online, and when is it worth taking that risk. I can't overemphasize the importance of have this in mind, so you don't blunder and just all of a sudden leak something to internet or infect your computer or reveal what's going on and then afterwards regret it. Then we had covered part 5 in the book, two chapter. That's where we had Cypher visiting. We did not cover chapter 15, I think, which is anti-assembly techniques. But Alexander Birke did cover anti-debugging techniques and anti-virtual machine techniques. So different ways that the malware is trying to find out, am I being debugged? And there are simple codes to check or flags to check. There's timing you can use. And also the bottom one, anti-virtual machine techniques. Many ways they can do that. Also bear in mind that the way things develop, few years ago, if you detected a virtual machine, you were sure I'm in an analysis environment. Today it's not like that, because many companies use virtualize their services for their users, and the malware wants to be there. So the bottom one here might be less relevant in the future, and already is less relevant than it was a few years ago. But still, the message here is that the malware is trying to detect that you're onto them. Then we had two assignments, and we have focused on report writing and analysis, of course. Assignment one, you were able to do whatever you wanted, and then in assignment two, I gave you Kato's format. I haven't quite decided what I will do on the exam. I'm leaning towards the what we used on assignment two, but that will be written very clearly in your when I hand out the exam. So there shouldn't be any surprises there, and if there are surprises, then email me. The exam is one thing, but if you're going to use this for your for future work, then use Kato's example, search online, and see what fits you and your company. It's all about communicating the right and understandable message to your leaders, and documenting in a way that serves your purpose. Okay. Now I have everybody's attention. This is not. There's some hot tips or some key things that this you have to be able to do this. This is not an exhaustive list, so there might be more on the exam, and I might expect more on in the reports. But you must be able to apply the basic static and analysis to form a hypothesis about the malware. That's a given. You also need to be able to use the basic dynamic to strengthen, reject, or form a new hypothesis. So that's the two basic ones. You should also be able to use the advanced methods, both static and dynamic, to investigate these hypotheses that you form, and be able to read assembly code, recognizing C constructs or malware functionality in assembly code. And you should be able to use IDAPRO or OLIDebug to find the location of that functionality. And then, of course, you should be able to write this in a report. I don't think there are any surprises up there. This is what I basically asked of you in assignment two. Exam dates. This is the latest information I have, and until I receive an update or change, this is what applies. Pay attention on Blackboard. I'll post last-minute changes there. But as of right now, home exam is June 1st at 2 until June 5th at 23:59. I know one of you asked, what about PINSA, because this is over a holiday. That question has been relayed to the exams office. I've asked for 72 hours, and this is what they gave me. I understand that it's not ideal to ruin a weekend, especially a long weekend. So the question has been forwarded. Whether they choose to accommodate that I don't know. If they do, I'll change the times on Blackboard. But this is what you should relate to. Like I said, instructions for the exam will be clearly written. but I'm you deliver different formats for assignment 1 and 2. This time I just want to say PDF and be done with it, because it's something about the readability and the in Blackboard. For the written home exam, I want you to do it in English. And then, as long as you pass that, we'll meet again for an oral exam. 2 days, June 15th, or Thursday, June 15th, or Friday, June 16th. The exam office has promised me that that does not collide with whoever is turning in master thesis and need to present, because on the 13th or 14th. So hopefully they're right. The numbers in parentheses, you have 8 slots on those 2 days. The numbers in parentheses are the ones that gave me feedback on what day they prefer. If you haven't given me a feedback on that, you're free to do so, and I'll try to accommodate. If not, I will just assign the available slots on those 2 dates and announce that one way or the other. I'm not sure how that's announced. I'll do it in Blackboard, unless the exam office has some fancy... Yeah, do you have a place where you get the exams announced, or that you expect to get this information, or no? Nope. I'll make sure you know. I've gotten a lot of questions about Skype. Yes, Skype is possible. I'd be very happy if I can see some of you face to face, but we'll accommodate this on Skype. Since I haven't met most of you, the challenge is, how do I know it's you at the other end when I use Skype? But I'll we'll see how we do that. Maybe I have to bring your passport or something. I don't know. That's something I'll take up with the administration. The language for the oral examination that you can choose. I've done all the lecturing in English. All the teaching material is in English. If you find it's easier to do it in English, please do. But myself and the second examiner that will be with me, we both speak Norwegian. So if you're stuck and uncomfortable, and then on this part we'll have both options open. What else can I say about the oral exam? Again, you'll get this in writing, in case I adjust a little bit, but what I'm picturing is that you will start with a presentation where you present the results of the home exam. 10 minutes, something like that, just a short presentation. Again, if you want to do that in English or Norwegian, that's up to you. I find it myself that is sometimes difficult to translate all the different terms that we talk about into Norwegian. But yeah. Final reminders. Yeah, I've tried to put the emphasis on a few things. Just a quick recap here today, but this is my. Door out. If I mention it, it might be in there. All right. We'll cover that in a little bit. Are there any questions from online, or any from the audience? Everything is crystal clear, as always. This I should have done a long time ago. My fault. Ideally, I should have gotten a couple of one on-campus and one off-campus student to collect and summarize the feedback on everybody's behalf. That's not realistic now. What I'm hoping that you can do, and I highly encourage you, and please, it would be so valuable for me and also the students that are coming after you, if you tell me what did I do right and what did I mess up. And it's always nice to hear what hey, this was fantastic, or this was nice, and yes. But what really makes this, lets us improve this, is if you can tell me everything that didn't go right. if it's just a minor detail or a big thing. I picked up a couple of things myself through the semester. For you guys online, I figured that having the lecture and the lab right after each other might not be ideal. So I'm considering next year to have the lecture early in the week and the lab later. So it's you have time to watch the lecture before we meet online for the lab. If you have other suggestions, let me know. I found it difficult to I'm curious how we can improve this lecture for especially for people online, because I'm used to the dialogue in the classroom, but I don't get the feedback from online as quickly at least as I would hope for. So how can we improve it there? I've written a deadline there just so that you don't it's I think it's 1 week after the exam so done. Take 5 minutes, write down what you have, don't structure it, just keywords, and then I'll be happy. Then I want to mention one network opportunity. This is from Symantec. They have a meetup. This is in Oslo, regular event where you can meet like-minded people. So if you're in that area, this might be an event where you can continue to meet people in this field. And then, this was my first try. So you've been my guinea pigs in English, or forsøkskanin in Norwegian. So thanks for almost that volunteering, but letting me try this out on you. And that's except for the exam, then that's the what I plan to say today. Then I'll remind again everybody, 4:15. That can't be right. That's stuck, isn't it? What time is it? 09:33. Okay, 1 hour wrong. 10:15 in this room, guest lecture from Kripos, Gunnar Alendal. Please join us. Anything from online? Nothing? Same procedure as last lecture. Okay. Okay. With that, I'll thank you, and that was the end of this, at least the lectures. All right. Hope to see you. See you at the exam.
can't talk. Can't talk.
Hallo, 1, 2. Hører dere meg her inne? Da håper jeg lyden er ok på strømmen nå. Begynner vi om et par minutter. We will start in a few minutes and switch to the international language. So, okay, be back in a couple. One, two, testing. Hello, welcome. Hope the sound is okay for people online as well. Welcome to final lectures in IMT 4116, Reverse Engineering and Malware Analysis. So those of you that take the class, pay attention. This exam is coming up. No, I'm just kidding. This is a bonus. One of my PhD students, Gunnar Alendal from Kripos, is here to talk about GOT hardware crypto on the insecurity or security of the self-encrypting device series. And he promised to keep within 45-ish minutes. So, but we have the stream going until 15:15. So when there's about 5 minutes in, I'll come up and tackle him. Hope you enjoy this. And the floor is yours.
All right. You can hear me? All right, I just want to get going because we have a lot of ground to cover. I guess I am invited to sort of encourage you, since you're doing a reverse engineering and / malware course, that this is sort of a different side of the reverse engineering part you're probably touched into. So this is has nothing to do with malware, well, not in this form, but has a lot to do with reverse engineering. And this that means that all of this I'm presenting is result from reversing, but not in the sense that you probably know it from this malware training, but I'll get into that. But the focus will be on the results of the reverse engineering and not so much on the reverse engineering. So please ask me if I use phrases or assume something that you don't know. Just stop me and ask, because it's better to ask me during the presentation so we can sort of clear the air if there is something I assume you know and you don't. So just feel free to stop me and ask, and I'll try to answer it. And if I manage to get through all my slides in 45 minutes, I have some bonus reverse engineering slides for sort of this topic, but you can use them as well in malware reverse engineering. All right, enough talk. I have a background in cryptography from University of Bergen, very mathematical background, and wanted to do something more hands-on, so I've done a lot of reverse engineering since that, but after I finished the university. So you're sort of ahead trying to learn reverse engineering from the university. When I learned this in 2000-ish, it was sort of a bad thing to learn. It was sort of a black hat thingy, but now it's more accepted as a sort of a okay to learn about reverse engineering. We need it. And so I like reverse engineering, of course, and I like to reverse anything. I have reversed a lot of x86, x84, and whatever. Yes. What is this all about? It's about devices, and this is getting more and more relevant. It's about devices. You have a device like this, and I have to mention that all of this research is pure hobby research. This is not done, this is not sponsored by anything, and did not do it during work hours. It's just that one guy held up one of these one day and said, hey, this is a hardware crypto. Anyone knows how secure they are? And, well, the answer is no, because fewer people look at code running on these devices than on the personal computer. Why is that? That means that hardware and firmware are less exposed to security researchers, because they are all focused on the personal computer and have been. But now we have all this emerging, everything is embedded, everything is mobile phones, everything is Internet of Things, everything. So we have more and more of these devices going to infect our lives, and basically no one's looking at the security. So they are everywhere, and they are running code. This is code. This is not x86, but it's code. It's a tiny processor in here, or there are actually more of them, several of them. But it's running code, and it's running security-related code, like hardware encryption. And, well, it's a, I don't expect you to answer that question, but should we trust them? Of course not. Just imagine my phone as well. Look at this. It has shitloads of devices in it. You have Wi-Fi, you have the baseband, you have the main processor, and you have USB, you have everything. Everything is a chip. Everything's running code. So the agenda is, well, it's basically these drives, which you can relate to anything that's embedded, basically. But these drives are hardware encrypted. That means they enforce mandatory encryption. And we will see that they are completely broken. We don't know why they made such a poor code quality, but you can all speculate. And the funny thing is that what I'm going to present to you was discovered and reported in 2015, and they have yet to fix it. So it's still zero day, which is very disappointing. Yes. No. Okay. Your question is if they do a proper research on their own devices? No, probably not. But I'm just speculating. What happens is that on these devices, you have all kinds of chips from all kinds of vendors. And you have Western Digital just buying them and embedding them into their finished product and selling them. So they probably buy the firmware as well. And they probably can't do the evaluation. They just have to trust their vendor to supply secure code. Because we have looked at very different chips, from very different vendors, and they all have their own security-related issues. So, but the disappointing thing is that they haven't fixed it. They could easily fix many of these issues. And they actually, Western Digital actually won a Pony for this. I don't know if you know Pony Awards, but that's sort of a prize giving to all kinds of best hacks and best vulnerabilities, and also to the worst vendor response. And Western Digital won a worst vendor response for this because they haven't fixed it yet. Yes, this is just we looked at 6 different chips. That means inside here, I just have to, you have to imagine that this is a virtual, there's a PC here connected to USB, and there's just a normal hard drive in here, just a normal hard drive. And to be able to talk to the, I'll just show you the hard drive itself. So it's just a normal hard drive, but for that hard drive to talk to that PC, you have to have a USB to SATA translation layer. So he needs to translate from USB to the SATA interface on the normal hard drive. And that's where all the magic happens. So these chips are just 6 different USB to SATA chips that does that translation. So they have sort of added the burden of fixing the crypto as well. All right. There are 2 different versions of them. You have the first generation. This is a first generation. There you have that chip that sits between the USB and the SATA interface, does the actual hardware encryption. And the second generation, you have the hard drive itself does the encryption. And we will see examples of both of them, but I guess they are more and more moving to the second generation. Yes. So this is the basic layout for all 6 versions. It's basically a host computer. You have some software there that accepts your password, and it does some magic through the password, sends over an authentication token, and you have the password have this bridge that actually does the authentication and the encryption and decryption. So this is the basic layout. It's very, you can see this? Yes. So here is the physical USB to the SATA, and here is the SATA, and this chip does all the magic. So it's very tiny, and it just sits there and does all the translation from USB to SATA. Yes. All right. Okay, I will not use the laser. Yes. 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 The question is that this software running on the host computer side, they only make it for Windows and Mac. They don't make it for Linux. But the question is, do they actually? Yes. How many use these devices? Well, they just want to sell to the majority of the customers. The majority of the customers using these drives are still using Windows and Mac, so they don't care. But that software part there is very easy to mimic. So it's very easy to make a Python script to mimic whatever you do. And sort of answer that, all of this research is done on Linux, so we don't use that software at all. Yes. So it's not user friendly. But I will not go into why they market just on the Windows or Mac operating system. But yes, there is lack of Linux support. All right. Cool. We had to speed up. And this is the basic security setup for these devices. Keep this in mind, because this is sort of the base for all the attacks. It's sort of attacking this model. And the model is very simple, and this is common for all type of password authentication schemes. You give in your password, and you have a KDF, a key derivation function, that takes this password and a salt, and it creates a key, and that's called a key encryption key, and that key encryption key protects the data encryption key, which is the holy grail, which is the key that protects the data on the drive. And it makes sense to separate them, because if you change your password, you don't want to re-encrypt the whole drive. So the deck stays static for probably the lifetime of the drive, but the keck will change as your password change. So if I do a password change, it will just re-encrypt the deck and store it. So that's important. These are just the different models and what type of architecture. You are familiar with x86 and maybe x64. This is sort of microcontroller-related code, or well, ARM isn't. But Intel 8051, it's everywhere, and it's running on these small microcontrollers. But you can see that there are different architectures. And we are basically left with three ways to attack this scenario. You have a self-encrypting drive, which encrypts data, mandatory. So if you buy this drive from the store, it's already encrypted. But the password protecting the keck is just not set. So there's encryption there. So if you drop it to the floor and you hand it into a sort of a data rescue company, they will, we don't know this, because if we read the raw drive, it's encrypted. Okay. Yes? Hidden.no. I'm not unfamiliar with them, so probably no. Yes, the three attackers' perspectives are sort of one, brute force the password, because we can attack the user's password. Two, we can attack the authentication scheme, the scheme that produces the CEC and does all that validation. Or three, we can attack the data encryption key directly. That's the three scenarios you're facing if you're going to try to break this. And this is sort of a generic way of approaching the problem. Well, we have three ways to attack it. Well, let's look at the first generation. Here you have the host computer side on the left. Takes the salt and the user password. You type in ABC123. And it does just a simple hash function. And iteration is 1000. Which, I don't know if you know, if a good KDF should have a very high iteration count to prevent brute forcing. And this iteration count of 1000 is very low. Very, very low. It's 250,000 would have been a better choice. But it basically iterates and hashes 1,000 times and sends that result, which then is a blue CEC. It's noted in blue because we don't know if it's correct, but he sends that CEC over to the hard drive for authentication. And the drive basically validates the CEC, and if it's correct, he will mount a drive where he automatically decrypts the data. So this is the basic setup for all of them, but they will solve it in a very different way. We will see. But this is probably, going back to your question about the different vendors, this is probably the design all the vendors get from Western Digital. Sort of, you have to fit this design, but apart from that, you are free to fix it and implement it your own way inside the drive, as long as you support this overall design. All right. Would they have to store all these data somewhere, all these sensitive DEX and CECs? And the CEC encrypted blob containing the raw DEC, the DEC marked in red, that's the unencrypted real hard drive key. We call the encrypted version of that the EDEC. This is an encrypted DEC, so that's in green because that's safe. It's sort of protected. So if you can read that, well, it's still encrypted. But that's, of course, stored on the drive, and it's stored on a tiny EEPROM, which is a tiny flash chip. So it stores it both on the drive itself, in an area on the all the way back on the drive, not used for user data. And he also stores it in an EEPROM. And the EEPROM, it's marked U14 on this PCB. The PCB is sort of the circuit board. So you can easily desolder it and read this. Okay, so if you can retrieve this EDEC, we can do off-device brute force. Okay? Because we can easily produce blue CECs, just simulate this host computer side and just try them on the encrypted DEC and see if they are correct. Okay? So if I can read that EDEC, then I can do off-device brute force. If I try to brute force on the device, he will try 5 attempts and then he will lock down and you have to take the power and restart the device. So let's look at one of the chips. Or basically two of them. And this is how they actually do it. They get the salt, the user password, and they do the SHA. They send the blue CEC over to the device. And you have the protected EDEC stored on the device, so he just gets it. This is the firmware that does all this. And he does a simple AES, electronic cookbook decryption. And inside that decrypted blob, there should be a magic ASCII string. If he gets that, then he knows the CEC was correct, so the authentication is okay. And then, after that magic, he just believes he has the true decrypted deck. So he just sends that to the hardware AES engine and everything is running. As simple as it gets. So you think this is looks good or bad? If you don't know, just a rhetorical question, but it's okay. It looks good. It basically takes a blind keck, a blue keck, and tries it to as a decryption key. If it's a correct decryption key, we will get a magic out and everything is fine. Okay, so it looks good. If you don't have a password set, there's an hard-coded keck. He will try that first. So if we're going back here, you can see that before actually trying to accept a keck from the host side, he would try this default keck and see if that is a success. If that's a success, it means you don't have a password or you just bought it from the store. And we call this a pi key because if you see the first line of the hex key, it starts with the number pi for some reason. I don't believe that's not a security issue because they have to have some way to support not having a password. So that's just a default keck. But that means if you don't set the password, I can break the encryption by just reading out the EDEC and decrypt it with a hard-coded PI key. Okay? And I can also do password brute force, as I talked to you about, and we also implemented that brute forcer on a GPU. So we got 1 million password per second, which is very high for a brute force, very high. And that's the reason for that is the 1,000 iteration of the SHA-256. It's too low. You have to have a higher. And also, they use a static salt. I don't know if I actually mentioned that. But if you see all the way to the left when they take in the password, the salt is to prevent you from doing efficient brute forcing, but that expects you to have a random salt every time you generate a new password. But they don't. They have a static salt, so you can just remove it from the equation, so the salt doesn't mean anything. That's why this brute force is so fast. But we want to do better. So now, if you remember my three attack scenarios, you can attack the password. You can easily attack the password by 1 million passwords per second. So most of us will just be happy with this because you will probably break all of your passwords very quickly. And back to retrieving the EDEC. There is a trick. I just told you that I can retrieve the EDEC since it's stored on the EEPROM. I can desolder that chip and read it. But that's sort of a destructive method because I can't get it back on. It's the risk of ruining it, and it takes some time. So basically, there's a trick we learned that if an embedded device, and this trick you can probably use for different settings. So keep this in mind if you're ever going to do reversing on anything embedded. When this little USB to SATA chip gets woken up, when you power him up, he will need to fetch the code, the firmware code, which is stored on the EEPROM as well. That means he gets power, he has a tiny little bootloader that's supposed to go to the EEPROM and fetch the rest of the code, rest of the firmware. But what happens if he can't access the EEPROM? So if we deny him access to the EEPROM when he boots, he will fall over into a DFU mode, a download mode, which is the basic fail-safe mode for most embedded devices. They will just fall over and say, well, I don't have a firmware. Please supply firmware. So all of these will fall back into such a mode, which is very good for security testing because basically it gives us raw access to the hard drive. So he says, well, I don't have any code, I can't do anything. He will just blindly translate any USB to SATA. And that means I can talk directly to the drive, which means I can read the last sectors of the hard drive and get the EDEC. So I don't need the EEPROM anymore. I can just read it directly from the hard drive. So then I can also dump the hard drive, of course, but that's encrypted. So I can see all this encrypted data, and I will see a tiny little blob on the end, which is the EDEC. So that's sweet. So it's very, very easy to do. It's it shows on the picture. I just have to short one pin to ground whenever I plug the power in. And that means that the data access, the data line to the EEPROM will be scrambled, and the chip will just fall over into DFU mode. Yes, this is just a slide summarizing the different ways we can get the EEPROM from the EDEC from the different devices. The last one is actually quite cool since you're into reverse engineering, because the last chip, it didn't go into fallback mode. It just sat there and waited for a new firmware. So there was no sort of blind translation from USB to SATA. So what we needed to do is reverse engineer the firmware and patch it and upload a new firmware that allowed us to read the last sector of the drive. Why can we do this? Because this is, of course, another big vulnerability here is that they don't have any firmware signing. So he will happily accept any firmware I hand to him over USB when he is in this mode, and he will run it, which is, of course, a big security vulnerability. But we just used it to read out the EDEC from the hard drive. And that's very simple. It's a 3-byte patch into the firmware, and that's it. That's all we need. All right. So how are we going on attacking this? Well, we know if you don't have a password set, we can just read the EEPROM or read the hard drive and retrieve. No, we don't. We just need the EDEC, and we can decrypt with the PI key. If you have set the password, we can brute force it with a very fast GPU implementation and to attack your password. But there are two attack modes still left. We can break the authentication, or we can crack the data encryption key. Oh shit, I'm poor on time. All right, let's move ahead. And first we're going to see backdoors. We all think backdoors are cool, and they're cool because once you discover them, it's just like you get very excited because you want to think they put it there on purpose, or was it just a mistake? And I will present you the back doors, and you can see if what you think, if it's a mistake or not. Two of the first generation chips, they have authentication backdoors. The first one has a hard-coded key, just relate to this as the PI key. So he will protect the KEC with a hard-coded key. If I can get that hard-coded key, which I can, because I can read the firmware and reverse engineer it, that hard-coded key is stored in there. So everything is laid out. The security is based on the fact that I cannot find that key, which is, of course, stupid. You can always find the key. It's just which doormat did they hide it under. That's stupid. And the other one saves. If you ever set a password, you remember you have a PI encrypted version of it, which he is supposed to overwrite with the new one with protected with your password. But he makes a copy of it. So he has a copy of the default one with no password set. So you can set the best password in the world, and there's a blob there with that best password protection, and it will, of course, work. But there's a copy of it, which is the default with no password, so I can just use that. Is it on purpose, or is it just someone just didn't think about? Yes, here is the first one. You have a hard-coded key, and you can see the setup is basically the same. You get the salt, user password, you hash it, and you get the KEC, the blue one. And it does a mem compare with the yellow KEC, which is the correct one, which is stored on the EEPROM and on the drive, just protected with a hard-coded key. So that's obfuscation. That's nothing more than that. So two of them just fall over and die once you start to look at the authentication. And before we move on, let's move on to another backdoor. Well, for the second generation drives, there are no hardware AES in the USB to SATA chip. The hard drive does all the encryption, but still they do authentication in a chip that has no cryptographic modules. That's just wrong. So that means they have a hard drive responsible for the encryption, and they have a chip that's responsible for the authentication, and then they don't talk to each other that much, which means the authentication and encryption is divided into two separate schemes. And that's, of course, bound to fail. And that failed, of course, because they just stored the raw KEC, the correct one, the yellow one, on the EEPROM. So there's no default key, no nothing. No, it's just sit there. So you can just dump it and use it. It's just horrible. And to make it even more horrible, there's a secret VSE. I don't know if you know that, but that's a vendor-specific code. I'm just going to touch into that. If I shove this in and talk USB to SATA, there are SCSI commands, which are a standard for talking to storage devices. And they have a set of defined commands. And they have a tiny range, which are open commands, which they say can be vendor-specific. That means the vendor can define their own commands, which are sort of secret, and they can do all kinds of things with it. They don't have to follow the standard on those commands. And so they have a secret vendor-specific code. Well, secret, I don't know, but it's just there. Nobody knows about it. And it's to dump RAM. So I can dump RAM, and it has the KEC in the RAM, so I can just dump the RAM, read the KEC, and just send it back as an authentication token. So this is the intended authentication. This was the design, and I can't imagine they draw this on the board and they were agreed that this was a good way to do authentication, but they did. So again, you take the salt, use a password, you do the KEC, the blue KEC, send it over to the device, and he has a plain yellow KEC, and he does a mem compare. If it's equal, he sends the yellow one. If they are not equal, he will still send the blue one into the hard drive. Yes. No. The VSCs, there is no list of these. These are intellectual property, so they will get angry if you sort of list it. So it's not listed. But many VSCs are listed because some people just post them when they get them. So there are a lot of listed VSCs. And I think we list some of them, but not the sensitive ones. But it's still there. They haven't removed it. Yes, back to this scheme. What's wrong here? If it's not equal, he will still send the blue one in. But why? This is because they actually know the right thing to do, but they just don't do it. What they should do is just remove that mem compare altogether and just send the blue one straight to the drive, because the drive does the encryption, so the drive should do the authentication. But they don't. So this is a gaping backdoor. So what happens? Once we know how they do this, we can do this. We can use the secret vendor-specific code to read out the yellow KEC from the drive when it's locked and just send it back. And the mem compare will, of course, be good, and we will always have a correct KEC, and we will always win. So that's the easiest backdoor in the world. And what's also the beauty of it, it's actually faster than this one. It's faster to do this authentication without knowing the password, or to authenticate with the password, because we don't have to do the SHA-256 1,000 times. We just read it and send it back. Let's see. There's a video. I don't want to do... We don't have the time to do it. Yes. Okay, what happens if... Yes, I have this one. This is a drive with that backdoor on it. So I'll just connect the drive. Just give it a second. And you can see that there's the software that pops up, the Western Digital software, which doesn't work on Linux. So what I just tried to do is that I tried to read just DD from the drive, and it says, no, I can't do that because you are not authenticated. And you can see that I show here, not authorized. Okay, so it blocks my reading. Okay, so, well, we can simply retrieve the keck and unlock the drive. So, I don't know, that's a very impressive demo, but it basically shows you that I don't care about your password. I just plug it in, I read the keck, and send it back in, and it unlocks. So that's a backdoor. So you decide if they put that in there on purpose or if they just didn't think themselves about, I don't know. There's a bit more complicated to do one of the other drives, so I will skip that drive. Basically, it's very easy to do. It's just more technical, and I don't want to get into the details. So now, back to the attacker progress. Now everything is changing rapidly to our to our favor. Well, if we are an attacker, that is. So you can see that we basically have one or two chips that sort of haven't fallen for the broken authentication scheme. That's the first one and the fourth one. We still have to look into cracking the deck directly. Yes. So let's go back to the first chip. This one does not have a broken authentication scheme because this is actually an okay authentication scheme. You use the keck. There is no keck stored on the device. He just tries the keck you provide as the key, and if it's correct, everything locks up. If it's not correct, it will just fail. So this is okay. No yellow keck in here. So do we want to brute force the blue keck, which is a 256-bit AES key? No, we brute force the password and not the keck directly. But what about the deck? Can we brute force the deck? Can we brute force the AES key directly? To answer that question, we have to ask ourselves, how is this key generated? How is it created? Remember, when you buy these drives, they are already encrypted. That means they already have a deck on the device, and you don't know where that came from. What's the entropy source of that key, and can we beat brute forcing that key? That's a 2 to 256 complexity, which, of course, it's equally hard as breaking AES. We don't want to do that. So how is the deck created? Well, we don't know how they do it on the factory, so we just have to mimic what we can do as a customer. We can erase the drive, which means creating a new deck and sort of invalidating all of the data that's on it. So if you forget your password, there's a feature, I forgot my password, it will erase the drive by creating a new deck. So if we study this deck creation process, can we assume that they use that deck and creation process on the factory as well? Well, let's look into the erase command, which is basically a command from the software to the drive says erase it. And he will take two entropy sources. Entropy sources are basically all that matters when you create a key. You have to put some random thing in here to make it as random as possible. And he takes two sources for that input. The one comes from the computer, and one is from the device itself. So he has two sources. The first source comes from the computer, and it's quite encouraging because that's a very, very poor. He sends 256-bit key material, but it's basically 32 bits appended or repeated 8 times. So he does the get tick count, which is basically the current tick count of the CPU, which is, you can think of that as just a counter of opcodes on the CPU. The point is that that's only 32 bit, which is easily brute force in seconds. It's 32 bits, and he just repeats it 8 times and sends it over. That's not 256 bit. That's just 32 bits repeated. And he mixes that with an onboard random generator, and he XOR those together and creates the new deck. I have to speed up. So, how about that random number generator? It's implemented in chip somewhere, and if you're going to reverse engineer this, you will just reverse engineer the firmware that reads and writes to a specific address. You have no idea what that is, but it's the random number generator. You just have to guess. So you just have to guess. But we know some way to send in comments so we can sort of get some results from the random number generator. Because every time we send a status command to the drive, sort of asking him, are you locked or unlocked? We will get 4 bytes back, which are originated from the RNG. So we can sort of try and get some data from it and sample it. So this is what we do. We will sample the random number generator to see if it's random, basically. And first I show you what happens if you get 32-bit, that's 4 byte, from 10,000 iterations asking you random on a Linux device. This is just a scatter plot, which basically says the lower 16 and the higher 16 bit of this number, and I just plot it. So if I have one dot and they are spread all over, that means they have a good spread, which is probably good for random randomness. And if they sort of cluster together, then there is no randomness. So this is the result. That's definitely not random. They cluster together, which means a big cluster covers identical numbers. So you can see I have a few dots, few large dots, and actually if you do count them, there are only 255 dots. So I can only have 255 different values. So let's skip this. It turns out that the random number generator that sits on the device, it's just a linear feedback shift register, which is just the simplest way of generating a series of numbers. So he just, you ask him, hey, can I have a byte? And he will give you a byte. And you ask him, can I have another byte? And he will give you a byte. And he will do that in a sequence of 255 before he goes back, and you will get the same sequence. So after asking for 256 bytes, you will get the same sequence all over and over again. That's not random. So that has a complexity very close to 2 to the 8, which is very ridiculously low. That's basically a one byte you don't know what it is. It's one out of 255 values. It's not 256 because you cannot have the value 0 from a linear feedback shift register. Then he will just blank out. So all non-zero bytes. So that ends up with, we have 32 bits from the host computer and 8 bits from the random number generator that's on board, and that's basically 40 bits. That's ridiculously low compared to 256. So yes, you erase the drive and you set the, it will generate a new hardware deck key that's sitting there for probably the rest of the lifetime of that drive. And it's just 2 to the 40 of complexity of brute forcing that. It's even worse on Mac. Don't let me get into detail because it's shorter than 32 bit from the Mac. So I can do that in no time on any computer. 40 bit is ridiculously. I can brute force your key in no time. But we still don't know how they do it on, this is just repeating that slide. We have 32 bit from the host, and we have 8 bit from the RNG, and we get a new deck. But you are all thinking, most people don't erase their drives. No, probably you won't. So I guess 99% of the drives will have the factory deck sitting there the whole lifetime of that drive. You don't ever erase it. So you don't use that scheme to create a new deck. So how about the factory decks? Do they use the erase command? Now I'm going to speed up because this is getting very technical very fast. But what can we do? Well, we can grab a set of drives with the deck on it and look at them. And remember that we solved the onboard RNG problem. So we can sort of take a deck from a factory drive and remove the RNG part of it, and then just sit back with whatever the host provided if they use this scheme. Okay? So I took a bunch of drives, got the deck, and I know that that deck, once it was set, it should have gone through an XOR with the RNG. I know what that is. And also, I know the state of it when the key was created, because the EDEC actually leaks the state of the RNG. I don't want to get into detail there, but it basically leaks it. So I know the 255 states values it carried, the linear feedback shift register had. So basically, I know from the deck, I know the host provided key material. Okay. So the bottom line here is I can go backwards with the factory decks. I start with the deck, remove the RNG layer from the onboard device, and then I sit with 256 bit, which comes from probably the factory. So if they used a Windows machine, we should see 32 bits repeated 8 times, right? But we don't. This is an example. This is 256 bit from one of the factory decks. But you can see that it's not repeating 8 times, so it's not a Windows machine. But you can see something from this stream of bytes, is that if you read them out 4 at a time and flip them in little endian format, you can see that they are listed here. Do you see something suspicious about these numbers? After one cup of coffee, you will see something suspicious about these numbers. But look at the first byte of all those 32-bit numbers. It's never higher than 7. So it's never 8 and upwards. It means the upper bit is never set. And once you have a few years of reverse engineering experience, you will recognize this and you will say, hey, this comes from rand function on the standard C. Because if you call rand in Linux box, you will get a 31 byte value back. You don't get 32. It will only give you 31 byte. So this looks like srand and rand on any standard C library. So basically, if I seed the random number generator on my Linux box with that number, 4F, D4, 5D, 3F, I will get that sequence of numbers. And what's that red number there? That is the only entry source from the factory. And what is it? It's a Unix timestamp. And it says it was created on the 10th of June 2012, and it was a Sunday, and it was a nice weather, probably where the factory is. So it's ridiculous. So it's not even 32-bit entropy, because it's a Unix timestamp, and that shrinks that, it can't be 32-bit anymore, because it has to be a clock. And what makes it even worse is that the drive itself has a printed production date. And that key, that deck, has to be produced after that date, because they produce the drive and then they sort of ship it further down the production line and they produce the deck. So if you remember my key, it was dated 10th of June 2012 and the drive was marked 9th of June 2012. How many microseconds does it take me to brute force that red value? It's ridiculous. So, yes, I'm getting there. So that's ridiculous. So I can just I just need one encrypted block from the drive, which I know is a known plaintext attack, and there are lots of them, because in the start of the drive, if you have had a lot of encrypted zeros, I just get one of those, and I just hammer on 2 to the 36 in complexity, and I will get the key. And I can do it even better. That's done in no time if I do brute force. It's done in seconds, so I shove in the drive and I'll just brute force it. But I can do it even better. I can instantly, I can create those keys before I do the attack. So this drive, it's a 2 terabyte drive. It has 1.2 terabyte lookup table for all keys that ever have left the Western Digital factory. It's all of them. So I just get one encrypted block, 16 bytes from the drive, and I can look up the key instant. I don't know if we are going to look at the demo. It's just rounding it up. So that's ridiculous. Yes, I don't know if we should go into more, but of course, all kinds of other evilness can we do with this. The fact that when we started this research, we were going for the bad USB thing, but that was before the bad USB presentation, because we recognized that we could easily patch the firmware, and you will hand out that drive and send it around to different people, and we can infect your machine just by doing that, because we can patch the firmware, and it's unsigned, and we can infect all the machines. It's a slowly malware spreading, but it can do that. And also EvilMade. So EvilMade is basically, I can get the drive from your hotel room, and I can patch the firmware and give it back to you, and it will log your password instead. All right. Cool. They all went to hell. That's the summary. And it's actually quite... I get sad when I find this, and I get even more sad when it's 2 years ago and they still haven't patched it. Questions? No, it doesn't care, because I can brute force it in a few seconds. I just need to brute force 32-bit. So it just takes me 15 seconds instead of 1 second. So no, it doesn't help. Sorry. It does help to reset your deck if you know these vendor-specific codes, because then you can send in 256 bits from you random, and then you have a secure device. So you can fix it yourself. No, why they use 8-bit linear feedback shift register, I don't know. But my experience with reversing embedded devices is that everything costs money. So if they go to the management and say, hey, we have to spend $1 to have a secure RNG on board, they will say no, no way. And they say, well, we need another dollar to hire a proper coder. And they will say, no, you can't do that. So they will always go for the cheapest solution, that sort of just enough so they can slam on AES hardware encrypted device. And it's also FIPS 140-2 approved. And then you think, oh, hey, it's approved, but that only means that it's approved that they have implemented AES correctly. So they have implemented AES correctly, but the authentication scheme is broken. Yes. Yes, there is a paper with the same title, and it's out there. If you don't find it, I can send it. No problem. The paper, or yeah, it's one Google search away. Yes. 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 I did this. I will repeat the question. Yes, if there's a question. But I understand your dilemma. Yes, we can use this for good, because we can use this to secure data from encrypted devices. Why the hell should I tell Western Digital, and which side am I on? Because we basically find vulnerabilities, and this time it's reported and it's written in a paper, and you see they don't fix it either way, so it doesn't help. But on the other side, we could find vulnerabilities like this and just keep it secret, like three-letter companies or organizations in the U.S. They do this, and they sort of are proud of telling you that they do that. They don't keep it secret either. They will do that. They will find a vulnerability in iPhone, and they will keep it secret. They don't tell Apple, because then it's fixed, and then they will sort of shut their own door. So I don't want to give you an answer to that, but it's a known dilemma in law enforcement that, well, who do we protect? If I tell Western Digital, I might protect Norwegian citizens from getting their data acquired by some spy agency, or I might keep it and use it to solve a few cases. I don't have the answer.
Okay, thank you, Gunnar. And with that, we'll close this this guest lecture. Thank you very much, and also the IMT 4116 course. And good luck with the exams.